From PPRO, this is Payments Radio, the show for and about the payments industry, covering news, interviewing experts, and talking about all the way the world pays. This week we bring you Apple Payments expanding into devices, Square's Q2 results, some updates on some super apps in Asia Pacific, is Monzo in doubt, some updates on their going concern, UK FinTech's investment slowdown, as well as capping off a bit of an update from PPRO with our growth results and some news on our latest funding round. My name is James, and with me I've got Matt.
Hi James, how are you?
Very good, and you? Great start to the week.
Yes.
Looking forward to the discussion today.
So James, our first topic today is talking about Apple Payments and how they're potentially going to be using the iPhone as a mobile payment terminal. What can you tell us about this?
Yeah, this is an interesting article that I found this week. So Apple's acquired a startup called MobiWave. Effectively, what they do is they turn any smart device or any smartphone with NFC technology into a point-of-sale terminal. It's been something that Android phones or non-Apple phones have been able to do for a while. And it looks like Apple's jumping into the space. It's very interesting to see that they've acquired a business to do this. Obviously, Apple's always had quite a closed ecosystem. They've been a little bit late to launch new technologies and new products, because when they do so, they want to do it right and they want it to be a complete end-to-end solution. So obviously acquiring MobiWave is a big move for them. They've had Apple Pay for some time. It's gained tremendous traction in Europe, starting to gain some very good traction in the US and other regions around the world. And now with this acquisition, it looks like they're almost closing the loop. So they'll have Apple Pay on the consumer side, and MobiWave or however they'll rebrand it on the merchant side. And effectively now, as a small business owner, I can just turn my iPhone into an acceptance device and you can come to me, I can plug in how much I want to charge my consumers, and you can just, I don't know, use Apple Pay from iPhone to iPhone, put it that way, which is super interesting.
Yeah, what's interesting to me was I actually thought that they could already do this, but I suppose they can, but you need extra hardware to do that. So my perception had always been that I'd seen Apple devices and I'd been able to have my payment accepted on them before. But actually, thinking back and after reading the story, it took another form factor, another device for that to be enabled.
Yeah, there's been startups that have been doing this for quite some time. There's Square, we'll get to that just now. Square in the US, a little Bluetooth NFC reader. There's iZettle and SumUp in Europe. There's a variety of these different players. But yeah, it's always been a separate NFC reader, or more importantly, a separate chip and PIN reader, for you to use the chip on your card, type in your PIN in order to accept payments. But now that you can do PIN on glass, it's enabled you to punch your PIN in on your phone. But also now the contactless is just becoming more widespread and there's very little limitations on Apple Pay transactions. And the majority of use cases, or especially for small transactions, you wouldn't need to insert your PIN. So it really is a fully contactless NFC transaction.
And then who's the user in this? So immediately you'd think this is an SME, right? Someone who's potentially starting their own store for the first time and already has an Apple device. That's a quick route to market for them. But if this is to gain traction and see a good return on investment, at some point it needs to make the leap from those sole trader types into, you know, the more medium part of the SME. And it'd be interesting to see the feature set that you can have with the Apple devices and how that compares to the top-end card terminals.
Yeah, I think it's also going to be interesting to see how retail pans out in a post-COVID world. The initial entry point, it makes most logical sense for SMEs. You have the Square, iZettle, SumUp type proposition. But then on the other side, you look at the Apple Store experience, where you walk into an Apple Store, they don't have a checkout. They have iPhones, obviously, with their, I believe it's Verifone or some other provider, but they've got iPhones with those Verifone terminals on the back, which is effectively turns it into a POS device. Now you just need an iPhone to perform that same transaction. So we might see other retailers try to build that Apple-esque checkout with no checkouts, with employees roaming stores, just being able to check out wherever you like. I mean, potentially there's it also leads to a checkout where you can self-checkout. I've gone to an Apple store and I've bought items without speaking to anybody. You go in there, and because it's a different mindset that you have when you go into the store, you don't have to pick up your items, go find the checkout, scan the product and leave. It introduces new experiences. You can just go in there, scan the items yourself, pay through the app and leave. So it opens up different ways of transacting, and it changes users' mindset, which I think that part of it is the most interesting piece of this, because this is the first step in it. It just opens up so many different possibilities. It isn't just let's do a Apple Pay to iPhone transaction. It's let's change these user behaviors. Let's get them transacting in a different way. And now all of a sudden, they're going to be using apps to transact, scan QR codes. They were taking them away from that card mindset. And it's that shift to digital payments, which I think is part of the bigger story that we'll see evolving over the next few years.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it would be interesting to see how other competitors in this landscape respond. And my guess is that there'll be some big partnerships coming up between the likes of Square, Rosetta, or SumUp to leverage their technologies with these new form factor of Apple devices so that they don't have their market share eroded immediately. And straight into that sort of frenemies, the co-opetition that we talk about so often. And I think really interestingly is looking at the investments into MobiWave, and that Samsung partnered with MobiWave last year. And one of Samsung's divisions, the venture divisions, also invests in MobiWave. So now MobiWave have the, you know, two of the biggest hardware device manufacturers investing in them and partnering with them. They're sitting pretty.
Yeah. No, very, very interesting. I've got the iOS 14 beta on my phone, and I've even noticed on the app launcher, when you swipe down top right, they've already there got an NFC tag reader. That's new to an iPhone. You always had to download a third-party app to do that. Now it's native within iOS 14. And I don't know whether it'll be iOS 14 or iOS 15. That'll include some kind of payments acceptance.
Yeah, for sure.
Probably most likely through the technology that MobiWave will be delivering.
Very, very interesting.
Definitely one to watch, especially if you look at some of the other news that came in this past week was Square's Q2 results. So they've been on a serious ride these past few months. So they posted 1.92 billion net revenue for the second quarter, a 64% increase compared to the same period last year. And you can see this is obviously a lot of that's driven by the lockdowns and the pandemic. It's driven by transactions moving away from the high street or big shopping centers to smaller retailers, SMEs, more localized commerce. And you can see it's obviously Apple was probably working on the MobiWave deal for some time, but it's just fascinating that we're seeing such good growth from micro merchants and these innovative point of sale solutions at the same time that happened. So very interesting.
Yeah, two things jump out of this to me. So the 1.92 billion is a 64% increase compared to the same period a year ago. Growth of that scale is lusted after by any company, but to get it from such a high starting point of almost $1 billion anyway to you know, over double is phenomenal growth. And hugely impressive. And the other part for me, and actually don't know too much about it, so it'd be great to hear your insight on it, James, is that it's the Cash App which was the key factor driving the growth and profitability. Yeah. Cash App, which goes head to head with Venmo in the States. You spent some time in the States. My view, probably quite reductionist, is that the US isn't a market that's hugely favourable to digital payments. They're still very card based, but if the Cash App is driving such growth, is that a sign of change?
Definitely, for sure. I mean, the same way, it goes back to what I said on the strategy for a lot of these companies. They have the acceptance side with their point of sale apps and their chip and pin devices that connect to smartphones. And then they have these consumer apps. I mean, a lot of them are not directly connected, but they've got two sides of the business. And at some stage, we will see those channels converging. We're already starting to see Venmo becoming a checkout option through PayPal. We're seeing it within the Uber app. And I would expect the same thing to happen with the Cash app. And it goes to the changing habits of consumers. We're moving away from that traditional form factor of payments, and we're moving to a new digital first transaction. And that's exactly what Cash app promotes. Obviously, it started as a peer-to-peer app, started as a wallet. You would load funds to it, and if I owed you money because we went for a meal or played a round of golf or something, and I owed you part of the green fees, I would just use the Cash app to pay you. And it's gained tremendous growth, and now it's moving into the e-commerce landscape. It's saying, okay, consumers are using this app a lot to transact. What else can we do with it? You can buy Bitcoin in the Cash app. That's one of the new features that's come there. So there really is a lot of possibilities. As soon as you get consumers to adopt these apps, adopt these use cases, you pull them into an ecosystem, and then you can build whatever you want when you have in them.
This leads really nicely into the next story around super apps. And I think what you're talking about there is, once you've got the consumers using an app, as we see so much with WeChat Pay and Alipay, bolt on services that they will find useful, and you can see exponential growth. So, some of these super apps are now almost the way people pay for everything, and people have their salary paid into these accounts in the East now. Maybe that's something we'll start to move towards too in some of the Western economies.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we've seen it happen just on the technology front. You look at the internet as a whole. 5-10 years ago, as a even just an online business, you would have to go to a variety of providers to build your solution up and to support your business. You'd make a website, then you'd go to a different email provider to get emails, and you'd do this, and then you'd advertise on maybe a different platform. Companies are bringing them together and converging them into a single experience. So Google's doing that, where you've got the advertising platform, you've got email analytics, you've got a variety of different services, you've got G Suite there, so they're trying to bundle in as many services into one. And this is just happening on the fintech front now. So once you're in the Google Pay ecosystem now, you can do payments. They're starting to offer credits to millions of merchants, and that's the one story that popped up this week. So Google said they plan to offer credit to millions of merchants in India through its Google Pay app. Again, it's just offering them an additional service. It's like, great, got them into Google Pay. What else are consumers asking for? What else are businesses asking for? Bundle it in, and then all of a sudden you're creating these super apps that that mirror the likes of your Alipay or your WeChat Pay.
Yeah, and I think the key to credit is always understanding your customers, their behaviors, how likely they are to be good for the credit. And I think if you're Google and people are running their businesses through your products, you probably know better than anyone and can make really informed decisions and make key learnings using your big data analytics capabilities. So it's another move we see from big tech into fintech. And with that, we're going to see lots of disruption, probably not great news for some of the big banks. But then we see another part of Google, that 8 US banks have teamed up to launch mobile first bank accounts within the Google Pay app. So big banks are coming to Google and saying, you're really great at user experiences. We want to use you as a product to launch mobile first bank accounts. Help us do that. And 8 US banks have done that. That's incredible.
Yeah, it is incredible. I mean, if you look at different markets, there'll certainly be different approaches. Google's taken the partner approach in the US. A good one. Obviously, there are a lot of banks in the US. It's a very complicated ecosystem to build a bank in the US. I would expect different choices in different regions. Somewhere like the UK, it's got quite a quite a good regulatory framework, and it would be quite easy for Google to get a financial license. So maybe they would, in an economy like that or a country like that, they might take a different approach. We've seen lots of neobanks pop up in Europe, and that's because it's maybe easier to develop these products there, whereas the US is extremely complicated. So partnering with 8 banks to build these mobile first experiences is a good play. It's a very good play.
In that we see here Google sitting behind a big bank, and with that, the bank is leveraging their brand very differently to what we saw with the Apple Card, where Apple effectively sat on top of a bank and said, we're going to make this really sexy and slick and make consumers want it, but you're going to do all of the hard yards here. And this seems almost the reverse of that. And I think for me, it'll be interesting to watch over the next year or two, which is the most successful partnership strategy with that, and whether we see either become the more prevalent solution, either big tech sitting behind banks or big tech sitting on top of banks. And what do consumers want, and how do they use that?
And who would they trust more? I think maybe a lot of it for the US is consumers' trust. Do you really trust Google entirely with your finances? At the end of the day, they are an advertising business. That's their core business. Would you trust them to look after all of your financial flows? Personally, I would be a little bit skeptical. So the fact that there's a bank behind them, there's a bank with hopefully good long reputation, makes it a more appealing product to me.
This is almost an existential question that we've definitely spoken about on a previous podcast and came up on a WhatsApp group that I was in this week. And it always comes back to value. What value are you getting from the services you offer? And are you willing to either erode a little bit of your trust or give away some of your data for that perceived value? And I think that's what it will come down to there.
Yeah, I think it's along the same lines. It's along a similar topic. Maybe we're just taking the conversation to Southeast Asia. So Grab, similar to Google, they're building a super app of sorts. Started off as a ride hailing business. Now Grab Financial Group has announced the launch of a suite of financial products. The three main products under their new strategy that they've dubbed Thrive with Grab are a micro-investment platform named AutoInvest, consumer loans via Grab's third-party loan platform, and the buy now, pay later payment plans for select e-commerce sites. So we have a micro-investment platform, we've got consumer loans, and we have a new pay later product, all from a single app. That's a lot to digest there.
It really is. And I think... That's so much to talk around this, but I think one thing I'd like to focus on in sort of parallel to this is some news out of Klarna. So buy now, pay later, credit-based products. They said they restricted their lending criteria during the COVID crisis. They still maintain just a 1% default rate. So, you know, if you can launch a product that maintains a 1% default rate that has good levels of acceptance, based upon the knowledge you have of these consumers, I think it's a cash cow for you to do. And Grab, again, another super app. People live within that ecosystem in the geographies they operate in. I think they're really well positioned to offer relevant products like this in a way that protects both the consumer and is revenue and profit generating for them as a business.
Yeah. And then even on the side, you have a buy now, pay later product that defers payments for consumers, allows them to pay later. And maybe with those extra funds that they have sitting in their Grab wallet, they can just pop them on the micro investment platform and let that money do a little bit of work for them.
Yeah, I mean, that is inherently risky to me, who's a relatively immature investor. And that would scare me. As a regulator, as a consumer, as a parent, if my kids started saying they were doing stuff like that, I'd be worried. But it'd be interesting to see what happens there.
Yeah, I know. I love those ideas. I'd be jumping onto that bandwagon.
Yeah, I mean, it's very Buffett-esque, right? He bought an insurance company because the float they generate. People pay their insurance premiums, and you may have to pay out in a big way at some point, but you've got general float which you can invest. I think it works if you're Warren Buffett. If you're Matt Jackson, you probably shouldn't be buying a product that you can pay for 30 days later.
Yeah, well, it's working for Grab, because also with the announcement of these new products, yeah, they've secured another $200 million in backing. So clearly they're building the right product, they're gaining the right traction. Consumers are using their new products, and they're moving the right direction with that type of funding.
Yeah, I think I'm correct in saying, and I'll check this and issue an apology if I'm wrong next time, but I believe Grab are profitable. And my concern when you hear about these companies like Grab or Uber, who take huge sums of investment, Grab has had $10 billion US in investment to date. My concern is always that effectively there's almost like a Ponzi scheme going on where they're just attracting this investment to continue growth without ever becoming profitable. But I believe Grab are profitable. One to check.
Yeah, well, they've raised more than $10 billion US dollars to date, and that includes a $3 billion investment from SoftBank. Obviously, SoftBank were also a big investor in WeWork. Mm. Yeah, let's hope they weren't just throwing cash at them to grow them too quickly.
Yeah. Time now, I think, to jump to something that we said would become regular, and it certainly has, the Wirecard scandal update. Maybe we need a jingle for this.
Yeah.
Quite a sinister one, if what we're talking about. So the probe has widened its net to the Philippines, and there's two bankers they've identified who may have forged documents. And more than 50 people and entities of interest within the Philippines in the Wirecard case. This story runs.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't pass my sniff test. I mean, they've identified more than 50 people, different interests. It just how did this go on for so long? I mean, maybe I'm being naive. I'm not. Looking at it, or not looking at all the details. I think I am. I should maybe do some more reading on it, but it just baffles me.
No, and I think it baffles a lot of people how auditors have missed it, how regulators missed it for 10 years. It's, you know, not much more we can say on that. I think other than keep this feature going and be interesting to see how it unfolds.
We'll Definitely keep an eye on it and see what happens with the new probe in the Philippines.
Definitely. James, this is one I'm really interested to talk to you about because I hope I'm not outing you, but you're an unashamed Monzo fan. You've spoken at length to me about how you use Monzo. I believe you've taken the leap that it's your everyday account, your salary is paid into there. Correct me if I'm wrong. Some doubt over whether they're going to be a going concern. Have you been communicated to as a consumer of the bank? And then also knowing that you take a keen interest in things like this, what's your view on where they are?
Yeah, I've been a keen user of Monzo. I've got a Monzo account. I've got a starting account. I always like using or just finding the best way to manage my affairs. And Monzo was one that struck me as a business and as an app that I really enjoyed. I was a beta user of their account. Full disclosure, I was involved in their crowdfunding round. So I'm a investor, albeit a very small one, if you look at its overall valuation. So I have been communicated on that. Monzo is extremely transparent as a business. Mm. If you look at it, the business as a whole, they communicate everything externally. I mean, you look at some of their downtime explanations. As a business, as a technology business, you have downtimes, and they are completely transparent. They give you a full breakdown of what's occurred. And I think to the point here, I don't see it as a concern. I think they're being completely honest and open, and there's no risk. If you look at the financials of the business, if you look at the way they've restructured the business, they've obviously had to lay off some employees. But it's really any business throughout a pandemic is going to be uncertain about what happens over the next 12 months. And I think they're just openly honest, saying we're growing. We're still fastly growing. We're not profitable yet. We've had to lay off some employees just to manage the change that's happened during the pandemic. And being honest, we don't know how the next 12 months is going to pan out. But from a financial standpoint and from a business standpoint, we're still very confident in our product. The board and the new CEO is still very bullish about the business. And I think that's it. I don't see it as a huge concern. I think if anything, the media has taken some of those comments in their annual report and blown it out, saying, okay, the terms that we used were quite generic. I mean, I am a bit biased here, so I'm a bit pro Monzo, but if you look at it from a financial standpoint and you look at some of the commentary that I've seen on Twitter and in other news articles about it, it's not a huge risk. But it's a risk at the end of the day for any business, actually, throughout the pandemic.
Yeah. Really interesting reading around it. So firstly, were you, you mentioned you communicated to, was that as a consumer, as a holder of a bank account, or as an investor, or both?
No, actually can't remember. I mean, I know I was communicated as an investor, that's right, for sure. I can't remember if I was communicated as a consumer. But I think this goes to the point. I think this was part of their annual report. This was part of updating their investors. They raised new capital also throughout the pandemic at a lower valuation than their previous investment. And I think it was just a rebalancing. So, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, and I'll apologize in the next podcast, but I don't believe they did communicate to consumers. And I don't see the need to, because they're still a strong business. They're regulated by the FCA. If anything, the FCA has recently increased their capital requirements. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they've noticed they're a fast growing fintech. They want to be secure and stable. They've increased their capital requirements, and I don't see much risk there.
No, and I think, so I started to do a little bit more reading about it, and there's this gentleman, I believe works for PwC in India, has done this neobank strategy teardown, which is like five or six different slides just about Monzo as a business. And what's really interesting is marketing spend's growing year on year, but the contribution margin per customer is increasing, and for the last 2 years has been positive, which is really good early signs. The number of products that they release continues to grow year on year. And if you think, you know, back in 2015, all they had was a prepaid account and card, and now they have, what, 15 different products, from accounts, personal loans, energy switches, savings marketplaces. So it seems they are well positioned. And what I think I like about it is that they're saying it's really tough. Who knows what the next 12 months is going to look like, but we're just being honest with the market. And I think spoke about last week that, you know, these new banks, neobanks, digital banks have the ability to have a more open communication with their customers and say things like this without it completely crashing them as a business in the way that some of the larger banks may be able to do. I'll just talk about that. There's a bit.ly link to this strategy teardown, bit.ly/2xh9yls. Really interesting and fascinating stuff. And I guess we can put it into the show notes as well.
Great. Yeah, I'll definitely be having a look at that after this chat.
Yeah. So one of their competitors, probably frenemies, Starling Bank, published a more bullish letter. And I only want to talk about this because there's a fantastic quote, which comes from Warren Buffett, who I'm an unashamed fan of. But Starling Bank are a bit more bullish about their outlook for the next 12 months. And during the letter, the quote he put in from Warren Buffett, which he said around the time of the crash, is that, only when the tide goes out do you discover who has been swimming naked. fantastic quote. And Starling clearly have their swimmers on.
Yeah. I mean, Starling, again, it's another strong business. I mean, they are directly competing with Monzo. I've got a Starling account. It's not my main one. I preferred Monzo. But again, I've got nothing against Starling. I think they're a great business. I believe they were not growing as fast as Monzo. I don't think they had the virality as Monzo, but still very strong business. Yeah, got a lot of respect for the company as a whole. It's a cool app. It's a cool proposition, and I think they're probably jumping on the bandwagon, saying, okay, Monzo at the moment from a PR perspective is looking a little bit rocky. Let's be extremely bullish on the positive side and try gain as much traction as possible. Who wouldn't do that as a business? Both strong businesses, both good consumer products. Let's see how this pans out over the next 6 to 12 months.
Yeah. Next story we'll talk about is, and this is really interesting that I've seen a really positive spin on this, and also a more cautionary view. And that's the news that UK fintech has slowed by more than a third as venture capitalists either choose to keep hold of the money or invest in more established companies amid the global pandemic. What's your view on this, James? I mean, the sums spoken about are still really, really huge. So, you know, very significant cash being poured into UK fintechs. It is a slowdown, but perhaps 2019 was just a fantastic year. What's your view?
Yeah, I think it's all relative. I think, yeah, for sure, it's a slowdown. But if you compare it to, if you compare it to last year, it's a slowdown, but you compare it to previous years before that, I don't know the numbers to hand now, but I don't see that making much of an impact. I still see a lot of money pouring into fintechs. Rightfully so, when the pandemic hit, you had to be a little bit more cautious. I think VCs maybe didn't sign some of those earlier stage deals. They wanted to see how the next 3 to 6 months have panned out. So I wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing in Q3 and Q4 an acceleration of that. We're starting to see a little bit of money coming back into some of those deals. Maybe some of the riskier deals we won't see back on the table. But I think it's quite, it is what it is. I think it was inevitable that there was some kind of slowdown. And certainly the businesses that did receive funding in Q2 and the businesses that have received funding over the past few months are certainly the more established, the stronger businesses, and have a really good growth story that they can receive investments throughout a pandemic.
That's right. And it almost feels like guess what? There's a global pandemic, people worried about money. Investment slowed down. It's almost like a no-brainer, right? But to your point, over half of it, $1.84 billion, was invested in just 5 companies. Revolut, Checkout, Starling Bank, and Infido, and then Thought Machine were the fifth largest within that. So, you know, like you said, going to the big players, interesting to see what H2 and then moving into H1 2021, whether we start seeing some smaller investments in some more early stage startups in the fintech space.
Yeah, I would certainly expect that. I think we have to see a bit of an acceleration coming out of this as businesses are opening, as we're figuring out what the new normal is. We have to continue seeing investment in the small guys, otherwise they're never going to grow. So I think over the next quarter, I would hope that funding picks up on the small scale.
Yeah, and you know, maybe leaning into that smaller scale, very good news from Pipro. Our company was announced just last week. 85% increase in transaction volume from last year, which is obviously fantastic growth. And some of that comes from the COVID-19 pandemic and everybody shifting towards e-commerce consumer behavior. Off the back of that transaction volume growth, we also announced the closing of a $50 million USD financing round led by Sprint Capital, with participation from existing investors, City Ventures and HPE Growth. I think the third time HPE Growth have reinvested in Pipro. Fantastic news for us. Really highlights the strength of our business. But more importantly, I think the strength of our core beliefs that e-commerce is going to become more and more important, and the consumer is at the heart of that. And you need to offer them the way they want to pay.
Yeah. I promise you my comments on the UK FinTech article there was not a setup for this. But I agree. I mean, I think it's we've had a great start to the year. Revenues increase as a whole. It's been a fantastic year, and I hope we continue on this trend. And I couldn't agree with you more, Matt. We have a very strong view and vision of the future, in that payments are going to increasingly become more digital, more online. These new experiences are extremely important for consumers. I think these new ways to transact are going to make it more difficult for merchants and PSPs to offer services in the marketplace. And yeah, that's what we help simplify for our consumers.
For sure. And I think without going into any detail, we are open that we're going to use the funds to scale the organization in terms of, I guess, resource, but also accelerate strategic growth plans for our platform, which means product and new geographies. Hugely exciting for us. Lots of work to do to realize the return on that investment, but so excited about it.
Great, yeah.
For all the listeners out there, if you liked this episode, subscribe and don't forget to leave us a great review. It helps other people find the show. If you know someone who loves payments, pass a podcast on to them. You can find us at PPRO, that's PPRO.com, or email us at paymentsradio@ppro.com.